Pushkin.
Until you get to that Zen place where you accept the fact that by putting work out into the world, you are not potentially opening yourself up to misinterpretation and unfair criticism, you are inviting misinterpretation. It's very easy to get in your head and be like, what's the point of this?
A couple of months ago, Rick Rubin and I met up at Rick's Shangri-La Studios with Ezra Koenig, singer and songwriter for the band Vampire Weekend. It was a Sunday morning, not long before the fires had devastated the area. Koenig was putting the finishing touches on the band's first album in 6 years, Father of the Bride. Our deal with Ezra is that we weren't allowed to air this until the album finally came out, and now it has. In fact, it's the number one record in the country. I imagine that if this conversation had happened today, it would be different, because the world has validated how brilliant Father of the Bride is. But back in October, all of that was uncertain, which is what makes this conversation so fascinating. Rick knows Ezra well, and there seemed to be a deep bond of respect and affection between the two of them. I'd never met him before, and I was struck by how open and thoughtful he was. He came with his guitar, which was sitting on the floor, until Rick gently suggested he hold it, and that's when Ezra really came alive. Father of the Bride is the first Vampire Weekend record without Rostam Batmanglij. Rostam had been with the band for a decade and produced all of their albums. So it was a change to have Ariel Rekshid as this album's sole producer. Ariel, whose work with Adele, Blood Orange, and Madonna came with Ezra to Malibu that day, and you'll hear him joining in the conversation, talking about how he and Ezra worked together, making sure the band was telling complete stories with their songs.
People are like, oh, you're working on a new Vampire Weekend record. Is it good? I'm like, yeah, it's good. What's it like? I'm like, it's a lot of Ezra narrative that is now completed. Like, each song has a message and it ends.
So for the last episode of Broken Record Season 2, we bring you a special episode. Ezra and Ariel with me and Rick talking about the anxieties of putting out new music after such a long time away. I'm Malcolm Gladwell. This is Broken Record.
Of course, the past few years is like a little nerve-wracking, like, oh my God, this is taking so long, what's going on? And then now that we're here, I'm kind of like, I don't look back on any time in the past 2 years as having been, that would have been a good time to release a Vampire Weekend album. I don't know if next year is a good time, but definitely the last 2 years weren't a good time. And yeah, I'm kind of been enjoying like saying no to stuff and pushing it, and you know, it feels right in a weird way.
Does it, when you say you're pushing it, is it because you're going back over things over and over again, or are you walking away from them? What are you doing?
A little bit of both. There's one song that we've tweaked so many times, and probably to a lot of people the difference is negligible, but we got it to a place where we're a little happier with how it sounds. And it's barely even arrangement, some very slight arrangement things. It's mostly mixing.
I think it's all arrangement. There is a moment where like the mixing becomes, turn this up, turn this down, but that takes 5 minutes. It's like cracking the code on arrangement is really what it's, when the arrangement's right, there's a wide margin of correct for the mix, I think.
Yeah, that's why we start mixing and mastering songs, and then they're not necessarily done, and then we listen to the what it a final version would sound like, and then we go back to the drawing board. And
how many iterations have you had of this song?
A lot, but the funny thing is that with everything on this record, the majority of what you hear, the spirit of what you hear, came very quickly, actually, and it's just kind of holding on to what was good about the initial burst of creativity, but also making it like a little bit more correct, if that even makes any sense. It's like hard to articulate because there is no rationale behind it. It's just like a feel thing.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of Pro Tools sessions, how many are there for the song?
I mean, a lot.
Hundreds?
Yes.
Hundreds of different versions.
No, hundreds of sessions. And so what that means
hundreds
is
of saves.
Like save hundreds versions. Of like, okay, like it could be as simple as just this is a little bit louder than that, and that's saved. Like, you know, session number 121 or whatever. But like big picture changes on this song, not that many.
fairly much. Yeah, it's not like when
because
when
up you until hear, like this like final one. Up until this final push, which was like me just being like, I'm not gonna be, you know, oppressed by this original version anymore. I'm going to break the mold of like the drums that we were holding on to and all this stuff. Up until then, it was pretty much just like two versions, like the original and then like starting to
one BPM slower or two BPM slower.
And then like maybe a few piano flourishes right. and stuff like that, you know.
But the palette never changed. Like, it's not like one of those stories where it's like Heart of Glass was like a slow reggae song and then became disco. Mm-hmm. So truly, even within these hundreds of slight variations, it's there's the for somebody thing. You might play them the very first version, this version, they'd be like, they'd know they were different recordings, but in spirit, yeah, maybe not that different.
Do you want to play the song?
Sure. Could play it. Okay, just play it right off here. This is the most recent version of this song that we've been tweaking forever.
We took a vow in summertime. Now we find ourselves in late December. I believe that New Year's Eve will be the perfect time for their great surrender, but they don't remember. Anger wants a voice, voices won't sing. Sinners harmonize till they can't hear anything. Thought that I was free from all that questioning, but every time a problem ends, another one begins. And the stone walls of harmony all bear witness. Anybody with a word in mind can never forgive the sight of wicked snakes inside a place you thought was dignified. I don't wanna live like this, but I don't wanna die. Like a young pretender's. Beneath these velvet gloves I hide shameful crooked ends of a moneylender. Cause I still remember. Anger wants a voice, voices wanna sing. Sinners harmonize till they can't hear anything. Thought that I was free from all that questioning, but every time a problem ends, another one begins. And the stone walls of harmony all bear witness. Anybody with a word in mind can never forgive the sight of wicked snakes inside a place you thought was dignified.
Thank you.
when you were listening that time, are there still things you want to do to it?
I mean, sometimes when we listen to it with other people, it passes by in such a blur that I can't even tell what I think about it. Did you hear anything you wanted to change?
You can always hear things, but you know, the second I hear something, I also hear the conversation that you and I are having
right
after I have that thought, and it's like, it's not worth it.
Yeah. That song, for whatever reason, because it's this weird like middle tempo, that's probably why it's been frustrating for us, that there's times, depending on how much coffee I've had or how tired I am, that I can hear it as fast or slow. So sometimes, especially when we're playing it for other people, the whole thing feels very fast and goes by quickly. The same way, like, if you have to, like, you know, like, give a speech in front of people, it, like, and then you're there and you're just like, it goes by very quickly. So I don't know. It's hard to, like, listen diligently in that kind of situation. But in broad strokes, it's like, it's how the song's supposed to be. So
what's interesting to me is I haven't heard it probably in 6 months.
Yeah.
And it sounds maybe 3% different.
That's all it is.
But it's 100% better.
Okay, thank God. That's good to hear.
That's best news.
It feels much more finished than it did before. Much more.
Great.
Which is interesting because not a lot has changed.
Yeah.
Well, then, you know this, that's the hardest thing.
Yeah.
You know, when you're sort of like, you're in this like beautiful old house and there's something wrong. It's like a little crooked and you're like just trying to fix it without redoing it.
It changes a lot of stuff.
Yeah. So,
and especially with us, because I go, when, like I was saying before, sometimes I'm surprised when I go back to an old recording by how bad my voice sounds or how rough something is or how maybe something just seems a little off. And so then I've also wondered at times, is that part of what makes Vampire Weekend who we are, is being a little fucked up, being a little non-professional. So that's always like a funny push and pull, like that we've very rarely used outside mixers in the band on a couple of tracks on the last album and on a couple of tracks on this album, including this song, because there's always been that fear of like, if our shit sounded too good or too finished, would it not be us? So that's also this whole other conversation to get stressed about.
Do you remember when you wrote this, what was the first thing that came?
It's a little bit complicated because the oldest version of this song, which included some of the lines, was, I guess, the a version of Stonewalls of Harmony, I'll bear witness, anybody with a worried mind. And originally it was almost like this kind of Baroque twee, like Kinks type song. And actually the only, aside from the lyrics, the only vestigial element of that is that kind of Baroque part. Bum, 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 ba, 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 bum, bum, with the arpeggios. So it was kind of like a very different type of song. And so it kind of started with, I guess, what we would call the chorus.
Did you write it on the piano?
Yeah, that part on the piano. And then I wrote the guitar part, boom, separately. And then when we started working together.
But not even necessarily, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
Not thinking about this song.
Yeah, yeah. The way these songs, my experience with Ezra and the songs is they're lots of ideas from lots of different places that we kind of stitch together most oftentimes.
Definitely with this one.
Yeah, it's like several.
So the riff was not part of the original song?
No.
No, so it was fun because, you know, like sometimes you have a good verse and then it's like time to write the chorus, and that's always like such sucks because then the chorus is going to be the most important part, and if the chorus is not as good as the verse, it's really frustrating and you might throw the whole song away. So at least here, in a weird way, we were starting with a chorus-y part, and then we had to work backwards to basically, my memory is that there's a song that had this, and the chord progression goes like 5-1-4.
Yeah.
And then I remember we were sitting there talking, well, if we don't want to have the entire song be 5-1-4, bum bum bum.
Oh, could you give him the guitar so you can explain it?
Oh yeah, yeah. Sure.
You have better access.
Yeah, totally.
So the part that I originally wrote on piano, you know, the chords are. So this is in B, so it's F sharp, B, E. So we already had the in stone. walls of harmony, I'll bear witness. Anybody with a... So that was pre-existing. And then I think at some point we look back and we're like, well, if the song is five, I mean, and these are like the simplest chords ever. So we're like, if it's 5-1-4, what could the verse be? And then we're like, well, it might make sense that the verse would start on one. So I vaguely remember us sitting at your house in front of the computer being like, the chords could start at on one and something could happen and just kind of like singing and jamming. And then I think I thought of that riff being like, well, I had this riff that went. And then we're like, oh, that makes sense, because it's like then the verse goes 1-4-1-4, and then it feels kind of big to go 5. And, you know, you're talking about 1-4-5, the most classic chords ever, so it's not some huge mystery, but that's kind of how it started to come together. And then I had to, like, write lyrics to it to make sure that there was actually some sense of storytelling or that it made sense to me. And I worked on that a bunch with another friend of ours, Dave Maklovich, who's kind of served as like my editor. For the first time, I really had like an editor on this. Just somebody to be like, I would show him the lyrics, he'd look at them, kind of mark them up, be like, that doesn't sound like you, that's a little trite, whatever. What does this mean? I don't know if that's what you're experiencing. Is that what
that's
editors
exactly
do?
What they do.
Okay.
It's almost disheartening to feel it, to hear that you have to go through the same prosaic bullshit that writers do.
Well, I actively sought it out. Yeah. I didn't, so because I always think that, like, especially on the early Vampire Weekend albums, and maybe that's some of the charm, I know when there's like a filler verse that is pure, I don't want to say doesn't make sense, that because that's being a little too hard on myself, I think, but you know, when there's a verse that's pure vibe. And I think just being a little older and wanting to try something more challenging, and also just having more experiences, meeting more different types of musicians and stuff. Because, you know, we just had the band. I hadn't been around other people's processes before. As I got older, and I'd sometimes get invited to a session, just watch a bunch of people pause and be like, what's the song about? That was big for me, because I realized I'd never done that before. What's the song about? I almost thought that was a prosaic question. What's the song about? Like, what's life about? You know, just like, it's about many things. Like, somebody like, what's Oxford Comma about? He asked me what Oxford Comma is about, man. No, and now actually I can explain what it's about. But so on these songs, I don't know if they're any more specific. There's other songs on the album that are very straightforward in a sense. But on this song, I was really like, it was nice to have somebody to bounce stuff off of. You know, me and Ariel did that too, but Dave was like very specifically like the kind of lyrical editor. So could really think about, I already had this thing, the Stone Walls of Harmony Hall Bear Witness. And this stuff is still vibey. There's still going to be people who say the song doesn't make any sense, but this one truly makes a lot of sense to me. So I had to pause and say, okay, I have this chorus. What does that chorus mean? What are verses that would add to it? And so like we really went back and forth a few times about like, you know, tweaking small things. And
do you remember one of those lyrical tweaks
on this song? Yeah, so there's always the Stone Walls of Harmony Hall Bear Witness. Anybody with a worried mind could never forgive the sight. And then the next part used to be different. I don't remember what it was.
I know. I almost remember.
Stone Walls of Harmony Hall Bear Witness. Anybody with a worried mind could never forgive the sight. I don't think it was always Wicked Snakes.
It wasn't Wicked. We landed on Wicked, and you like it was. That was a
I was excited moment. To land on Wicked. Yeah. Wicked's one of my favorite words, and this is like for the real heads. The real Vampire Weekend heads will know that I've used that word on a few occasions. One of which is on the Beyonce song "What a Wicked Way." Those are like my two. These will be my two real Wicked lyrics. So Wicked Snakes was something, and I remember coming up with Dignified was exciting because I was like, oh, Dignified is exactly the type of it makes sense in the context of what I mean. And also, you know, this song has like a touch of like Stonesy energy. And I remember thinking that like Dignified sounds like one of those words that kind of gives Mick Jagger, I don't know who wrote the lyrics, Keith and Mick Jagger lyrics, their flavor. Because I always like defend them passionately when people are like, they're just like ripping off blues songs and country and, you know, Americana or whatever. And I'd always be like, yes, that's true. And for whatever reason, though, I don't know if it's their Englishness or just their sensibility as human beings. They have these funny words, just like when McTerry's like, I saw her today at the reception. I just always think that, like, it's so funny and weird that he said reception. I don't know why. Just like, to me, that he said reception is like his weirdo.
It's not a song word. What? You don't hear reception a lot in songs.
Yeah. And then his delivery, reception.
Yeah. And dignified is not a song word.
Not typically.
No, that's what makes it great.
I remember at first it was something about, at first it was undignified, which I thought was even better. With your snakes inside, please. I remember I wanted to, it was going to be like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da- me anymore. That's funny, but you thought was dignified.
That makes it more country.
It's so undignified. Yeah, dignified, I wouldn't be surprised that popped up in some weird country song.
We'll be back with another song after the break.
We're back with Vampire Weekend's Ezra Koenig and producer Ario Rekshid.
When you said the editor sometimes said to you, that doesn't sound like you, what is something that doesn't sound like you? What does that mean?
I know, that gets so weird. It's that one, you just know it when you see it. Well, he's a musician, so he's in this band called Chromeo. And
more than anything, he's an old friend of yours.
He's an old friend. And he knows you. And he knows Vampire Weekend really well. So he knows the modes of Vampire Weekend. And so he would often tell me that something should be a little more Yahe, because that's one of our songs on the last album, which is probably one of our like heavier, more biblical songs. And so he would have a shorthand for referring to Vampire Weekend songs and being like, you could bring a little more of that side of yourself out here. And, you know, I've always had this experience with lyrics because they're so personal to me that, you know, I'll like go to the mat for something that I like, but I've always found working with other people, whether it's Ariel, Rostam as producers, or Dave specifically as this type of lyrical editor, where I know when I'm trying to slip some bullshit through. You know, so if somebody says, like, I'm not sure I like that lyric, but it's one that I know. I know it makes sense. I know it's poetic. I know it's me. Then I'll say to them, like, okay, all right, you don't like it. That's all right. Maybe you had a bad experience with that phrase before. Mm-hmm. But when somebody says, like, I don't know about that one, and I know it was one of those ones that I was sneakily trying to just hope nobody noticed because I knew it was cliched, stupid, meaningless, whatever, and then they're pushing on a sore point, and I'm like, oh fuck, you're right. Then I know I have to rewrite it. So I don't think I could ever do that by myself.
Yeah, there is some sense of, as you're writing, you'll have sort of the key lines that you know work, and that sort of make the song the song. And then there's a little bit of a jigsaw puzzle of sort of filling in the rest, and it happens to varying degrees of success. Like some of the lines end up just being sort of passing lines. But if someone's reading the passing lines as if they carry the same weight as the main lines, then it does force you to sort of analyze the lyrics more. You know, for the sake of telling the story, it doesn't make a difference. But for the sake of the poetry, it makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. You could do it musically or lyrically, that feeling of, you know, the song has special moments, so you know it's a worthwhile song. And then there's this feeling, but what if you went back and turned some of the worst parts into the best parts? Then the whole thing is better. And I think that happens a lot too, where somebody writes a good chorus, and you know it's a good chorus, and you're like, well, who cares if verse 3 sucks? But if you're talking about like a Leonard Cohen or somebody who would spend years revising, and then you look at like, it's cliched now, but like a song like Hallelujah, and you're like, damn, verse 3 and 4 of that song. I also have to say, I don't know exactly what verse 3 and 4 of that song are, but I know some of those later verses, like the one about I've seen your flag on the marble arch or something. And you're like, that to me maybe is one of the best lines in the whole song. And maybe that's better than the opening verses or something. And then that's what makes it probably such a durable, strong song, that there's so many entry points. And I don't know.
Can you pick another song from the album?
Mm.
And can we do this, a very similar kind of...
I've got kind of one that was fun and that I think Dave really helped me understand what it was about, and Ariel really helped understand what it was supposed to sound like. And this one is a tiny bit. There are like two people who said that this was not their favorite song on the album. So I always have been presenting this within our circle as like, this one's a bit controversial. Because some people it's their favorite, some people it's not. And it's this one called Married in a Gold Rush. And it's, it's funny because we did the earliest version before RL, you put in that like weird chopped up choir stuff and the weird drums was kind of like fairly straightforward, folky country on acoustic guitars. Like, and that, so basically that started with the chorus kind of. Oh, no, I had this verse. I knew that it was cool to start a song. Something's happening in the country, and the government's to blame. We got married in a gold rush, and the rush has never felt the same. I just thought that was a fun way to open a song. And I like this concept of married in a gold rush. It just seemed like... It's one of those things that it sounds like two bizarre things slapped together. You know, it's like married in a fever plus something about a gold rush, you know, turned together. And then the more I thought about it, I was like, but I always like when seemingly random things actually start to feel very meaningful. And then I thought about it and I was like, married in a gold rush makes a lot of sense to me. It's how I feel about life and the world and stuff. And then I was talking about it with Dave and I was like, is this just going to seem like... And it still might, I gotta be honest. But is this just gonna come across like a goofy, lightweight country excursion? And we talked about like, well, people are gonna hear it how they hear it. And I think the production, the arrangement helped take it out of that territory, but people are gonna hear it how they hear it. And all that matters is that it's like meaningful to me. So we talked a lot about the chorus. And also the song's a duet, so it's a man and a woman sing. It's Danielle Haim on the record. So the chorus goes like, I don't want to hear the rumors, please don't say it loud. I just want to go out tonight and make my baby proud. And then she goes, boy, who's your baby girl if you don't know by now? There's two seats on the midnight train, the gold won't weigh us down. And I think originally, this reminds me also of how long we've been working on this album, is that I remember when that Ed Sheeran song came out, where that kind of like tropical Ed Sheeran song, where he's like, there's some part where they say, girl, like, boy, you done the girl. And I remember when that came out, which already feels like a million years ago, but I remember we'd been working on the song for a while and be like, oh, damn, he said that too. That just to give some perspective on how long we take. But
well, if you wait long enough, we will all have forgotten the Ed Sheeran song.
Yeah, no, that's why we have to wait another couple years. But so that one, I remember before it fully came together, I think it started out, it was kind of more just some cliched, random, like, you know, rewrite of a country song from somebody who didn't fully engage with the material. I think originally I just had some vague lyrics that went like, I don't want to hear it, baby, please don't say it loud. I just want to go out tonight and make my daddy proud. Boy, who's your daddy, girl, if you don't know by now? It was like some weird, I don't know why I wanted to say daddy. That just seemed funny to me. My dad used to play some old country song called Roly Poly, Daddy's Little Fatty. Is that like a famous song? You guys know it? Roly Poly, Daddy's Little Fatty. It's about a little fat kid who eats corn and taters. And he's going to grow up to be a big man someday. So I don't know. The word daddy seemed funny to me.
That's a real story that you're telling?
Yeah, that's a real song. Roly Poly, Daddy's Little Fatty. He wasn't fat shaming me.
Was he really into country music?
Yeah, so he had like some strong country selections, but it was one of many genres. But so I couldn't get off the word daddy in the song for some reason. And so, but then I talked with Dave, we're like, well, what does that mean? And then I'm like, well, maybe daddy's a metaphor. Also, the album is called Father of the Bride, and I've had that name in my head for a long time. So the concept of like, father as a metaphor was already interesting to me, but I just want to go out tonight and make my daddy proud. And then the woman's asking, boy, who's your daddy? And then I remember just trying to come up with like some metaphysical answer. So there were like some bad versions where I basically said, well, you know, my daddy's like, I can't remember what it was, like the sky above, or it was like some kind of weird philosophical thing. And then we talked about it, like, what is this daddy shit? It doesn't make any sense. And then we kind of realized it's the whole point of the song, and in some ways the whole album, is trying to write songs that are about real conversations between people, which is the one thing in Vampire Weekend songwriting, even though I've done a lot of stuff I wanted to do, I'd never done something that simple, which is something as I get older, I admire more. A song where you know who the narrator is, and you know what the situation is, and you know what they're talking about, and it's something semi-universal about the relationships between human beings. So then it became, little by little, we talked about it. We almost started to, like, I remember Dave and I just having these long discussions about, because I knew on a gut level what Married in a Gold Rush meant to me, and it was like something came together when times were good, and now it's done. And Gold Rush adds this kind of, like, element of greed and finance to it, and I was like, that means a lot to me. So then we just had to, but we had to expand it a little bit to kind of paint a story about it. And we're like, what does it mean that he wants to, like, make his baby proud? And he's trying to tell the woman, like, and, you know, maybe they're teasing each other a little bit, but, you know, she's saying, who's your baby? And he's like, come on, don't you know by now it's you, essentially? And, like, let's get on the train. Let's not let the gold weigh us down. And we just kind of started to, like, talk about situations throughout history and, you know, and I remember at some point we were just talking. He brought up the family that owned, like, the Klimt painting in Austria or something, you know, and not to make it Judeo-Holocaust centric, but just situations where a golden era ends abruptly and people have to get out of Dodge and leave their shit. So anyway, the fact that Dave kind of helped recontextualize the lyrics with some type of setting for a second, then the whole thing became more meaningful to me, and I didn't have to worry as much about daddy and stuff. I was like, oh, these are two people in a situation. Maybe they're trying to have a sense of humor about it, but and I don't want to say it's specifically about that, but even just him throwing out that example started making me think of other stories and situations I was aware of. And just gave the whole thing a little more gravitas and just grounded it for me. And so in a weird way, like I was talking about before, this experience I had in my late 20s of being in a session with people and somebody like being like, hold on, what's the song about? Who's talking in the song? And that being very novel to me, this was like our version of it, where I was like, a lyric, a vague concept, you know, that's all I had. And then for us to the only way that we could kind of improve on it was to say, like, rather than searching for a vibey daddy metaphor, to say, like, let's, like, stop. What are these people talking about? And then suddenly, even though I can totally imagine for a certain type of listener, the end of the chorus, there's two seats on the midnight train, the gold won't weigh us down, could come across as cliched because the midnight train is, you know, just a cliche of songwriting. By that point, I was kind of into it because I was like, I like that this song maybe as a series of cliches that comes together to mean something to me. And I know some people will hear what I hear and some people might not, but then suddenly, rather than being a string of random things pulled from songs, it suddenly felt like something that was meaningful to me. And Married and Gold Rush and Midnight Train and all that stuff actually was telling a very specific story rather than just being a fun mashup of references.
Can you play us the little more of it?
Well, it's just funny because it is a duet, so
sing her parts in falsetto.
Yeah,
you do it. We sing in a pretty similar range on this song.
Yeah, so, her voice is probably lower than yours.
Yeah. So the opening thing is I go, something's happening in the country, and the government's to blame. We got married in a gold rush, and the rush has never felt the same. And then Danielle comes in, shared a moment at a cafe, shared a kiss in pouring rain. We got married in a gold rush, and the sight of gold will always bring me pain. Then it goes into the chorus. But so that, even that's an example where it's like, I think I already had that line. There's something I liked about the female voice singing. Shared a moment in a cafe. That's some like Mick Jagger shit. I just thought it. And again,
it is.
I think with our songs and the way we talk about music and what we do, there's literally moments where we sit around. I found sometimes people have been like found it bizarre when they hear me talk, and I think this is a lot of it comes from Dave, and I think Ariel shares a similar sensibility. We'll be talking about something, just be like, "Yo, that's funny," and people be like, "What are you talking? You're not like making like a comedy." But we do use funny a lot to refer to things that we mean kind of like interesting, meaningful, surprising. So at first, I think having a song like this and just having somebody go, cafe, just seemed funny. Shared a moment in a cafe. Shared a kiss in pouring rain. We got married in a gold rush. And the sight of gold will always bring me pain. But then as we started to say, like, fill it out a little bit, and again, this is like the shit that maybe only is meaningful to us, but, you know, talking to Dave, and even when he starts talking about this kind of, Viennese Jewish family owning a Klimt or something, and again, didn't try to jam that into the song itself, but even just to have that vision or that vibe in the back of my head, suddenly the references to gold felt a little more meaningful, and then even the reference to a cafe felt a little more meaningful too, because then you start thinking about like that was the golden age, Viennese cafe culture, or you know, there's similar shit in Germany, and then even the word cafe stopped being just kind of funny to like put into a song and almost had this weird resonance. And again, there's no way you can guarantee that the listener will remotely have that resonance. But yeah, that's another example of how having that kind of editor-writer type relationship helped me clarify what the song was about and helped me go back and be like, well, if that's what the song is about, the word daddy is just stupid. But the word cafe actually looks better in that light.
We'll be back with more from Ezra and Ariel after the break. We're back.
How much time do you think about what other people are going to think of the songs versus what you think of the songs?
Too much, constantly. And that's probably also part of the issue with why it's so much more fun to work on the record than to release it, because until you get to that zen place where you accept the fact that by putting work out into the world, you are not potentially opening yourself up to misinterpretation and unfair criticism, you are inviting misinterpretation, you know, until you get to the place where you just accept that that's the way of the world and that's how it is, it kind of, it's very easy to get in your head and be like, what's the point of this? I already did what I wanted to do. Now I know some people will like this and be excited and some other people will misinterpret it and, you know, call the thing that I think is meaningful dumb and call the thing that I think is dumb meaningful. And just knowing that it's going to happen, I haven't gotten to a place yet where I can fully kind of laugh about that. That still puts me off, makes me less enthusiastic about releasing things.
But how does the conversation end in a song? Well,
then the second verse goes, yeah, I'll just go through the verses real quick just because I like the second verse. The second goes, hanging gardens turn to desert. And then she goes, all that loving turned to hate. We got married in a gold rush, and those wedding bells were ringing out our fate. And then there's a bridge.
Third verse is the best.
Yeah, then the third verse goes, so after there's this kind of bridge where there's this extended metaphor of like an empty mine in an abandoned mine town. Then the third verse goes, I go, I thought you might learn some manners. And then she goes, I thought you might learn to sing. And then we go, we were born before the gold rush, so why can't I remember anything? That one's, I think I was happy with that mix of tone, because like the first part, I love in those old country songs when they roast each other. That was a song that my dad familiarized with me growing up, was I think it's Conway Twitty and Loretta Lynn. It's one of the classic duet partner pairs, but they have the song like, "You're the reason our kids are ugly, little darling." And I just realized like some of those the country duets are very emotional, but other ones they're just funny, and they have that tone of like roasting each other. "You're the reason I changed from beer to soda pop. You're the reason I," you know, like being a little mean to each other. So I thought there was something funny about, "I thought you might learn some manners. I thought you might learn to sing." That just seemed like what the, yeah, what Loretta Lynn would sing to Conway or Tammy Wynette would sing to George Jones or something. But then the next part, "We were born before the gold rush, so why can't I remember anything?" I think that kind of brings it back to the more eerie feeling of what the song is really trying to communicate. Some feeling of, we got brainwashed through this like good time, golden era, and now it's over. And I can't even remember what happened before then. So clearly we have to look to the future. And then the end of it goes, "Why can't I remember anything? Oh, I wanna put things back together. I wanna give, I don't wanna take. Time to disavow the gold rush and the bitterness that's flourished in its wake. I don't wanna hear the rumors." Then there's one last kind of slightly more triumphant chorus, but yeah, that basically is the resolution. And even that's new for a Vampire Weekend song to have resolution. I mean, we've definitely had a lot of third verses that took the song to a new place, but to me, when it's two people talking to each other in some weird transitional moment, that is a type of resolution. Like, I want to put things back together. I want to give, I don't want to take. Time to disavow the gold rush and the bitterness that's flourished in its wake. That also gets back to some of that Mick Jagger shit, just like throwing in those like extra words, like flourished. But again, that part is meaningful to me. That I remember the first demo we had of this before the song got like, got the cool drums and the cool groove and the things that really make the recording what it is. There was a version that was like upright bass and
yeah.
And I did, of course, and like I felt the story was shining through, but it still wasn't. It all kind of comes together.
Yeah, but it all leads off of the concept of the song. Yes, it's the form is kind of country, but it's not derivative country music. You know, I think you and I both have too much respect for
everything. George Jones.
For George Jones.
Is he your favorite?
I like him a lot. I like all the basic people that everybody likes. Tammy Wynette, George Jones, and Conway and Loretta.
We're not above having gone through some low hanging fruit ideas on the way. Right? I mean,
right.
Like, we don't even, you know.
It would have, and also I think if we had gone full country, the song would just be less interesting. What's cool about this song is sometimes you play it for people and people be like, it's like a country song. And then other people just be like, oh, that's cool. That's a very interesting thing about country, and is that back in the day, remember there, we've joked about this a lot. Back in the day, there used to be a thing that people would say, I guess like white middle class American teenagers generally would say, I like everything except rap and country. And then my joke over the past few years is kind of indie has declined or whatever, has been like, people used to say they liked everything except rap and country. Now music is only rap or country. Like, because the middle ground of rock music or indie rock doesn't make sense to a lot of people. And I'm saying that as just an observer. So the idea that you like everything but rap or country, like, what isn't rap/country? Got rap, country, country rap, rap rock, country rock. You know, what else, what is not rap or country? But if we...
Did you hear that Turned Up on the Weekend record?
Oh, yeah. Turn Up on the Weekend. That guy's from the Upper East Side, by the way. It's called Big Wet.
Yeah, it's like a country rap record, but ridiculous.
Oh, really? And yeah. He's from the Upper East Side.
Yeah. That's so fantastic. He made a persona. It's like auto-tuned country rap.
Went to Dalton and
yeah,
the whole nine yards probably.
Very literally may have gone to Dalton. But but there's something about like kind of realizing that, oh, country, it is kind of lame when people go country, because country is one of the pillars of American music. And also, even when people used to say these silly things, like I like everything but rap or country, they were listening to country. You know, I guarantee, I may have even known this person when I was like growing up. You know that there's probably a kid somewhere who's like, oh man, I hate country. Like, what do you like? I like Bruce Springsteen, the Grateful Dead, Tom Petty. You'd be like, yeah, you hate country, right? You literally are listening to country. I like the Rolling Stones. Half their songs are country. Even Grateful didn't even have pedal steel sometimes, but
yeah.
But again, you like The River by Bruce Springsteen, but you don't like country. You know, at some point, you're just calling things by different names, and I think kind of realizing that made it feel like okay, there's nothing wrong with kind of leaning a little bit into country as a songwriting form or a pillar of American music, but there is something that just didn't feel like us about going country. So we tried to make sure that there's some brief moments on the record that lean that way, but it ultimately hopefully comes across as one of many flavors. And I'd like to think that the song, in both the songwriting and the production and arrangement, tips its hat a little bit to some of these classic country duets, but not in some like big like dress up genre way, like the way that, you know, like the Rolling Stones' Far Away Eyes. It's literally Mick Jagger being like, I'm a stupid southerner. Like, he literally puts on this voice and is like, I ran 10 red lights for Jesus. I was like, that's a bit much. I do like that song, but it's still a bit much. Hopefully we just, you know, kind of using it as a almost as like a poetic form, the country duet. What do you learn from that? You know, two people talking to each other in a country song. What do you take from that other than, you know, pedal steel and southern accents, you know?
Did you always have your, who was your, you said your duet partner was?
Oh, Danielle Heim from the band Heim. And there's three duets with her on the record, and she's a big part of it.
Did you always have her in mind when you were writing those duets?
No, I had not exactly. And even in some weird, so it's originally I kind of thought, well, maybe we'll get a country person, a country singer. That could be interesting. Some like, you know, reaching across the aisle type thing. And had some conversations and reached out to a couple people. And I had like one conversation with somebody's manager about like, you know, maybe bringing them in. And with this person who's like a fairly well-known country singer, and the manager responded and was like, oh, you know, she knows Vampire Weekend a little bit. She thinks you guys are cool. Like, can we jump on the phone and talk about it? So I talked with her and I, you know, kind of made a pitch to her about why I think it could be interesting. And she was like, all right, well, you know, just send us the song and we'll take it from there, which I think is very typical in almost every form of music, including modern Nashville country, where you would, of course, it makes sense. Send us the song. We'll see if we like the song. And then we were like making a little bounce to send. And there's something about it just didn't feel right. We just couldn't bring ourselves to send the bounce because it was like, there's something about it that just felt too empty. And again, for all the ways in which the indie world has ceased to exist or the way we make music has changed or whatever, that's one of the few things that I'll probably always hold on to in terms of indie spirit, is like things have to happen organically and you have to have a relationship with the people you make music with.
You wanted her right there when you were singing it. Is that what you're saying?
I want to be like, you know, next time you're in LA, come by the studio, listen to the song. We can play the whole, everything we've been working on. You can see how you feel. You could try putting down some vocals, see how that sounds. There's something about just like sending the song to say like, what do you think of the song? That I just felt like, that's just not how, and again, I'm not judging. I can totally see it from their point of view, but we just couldn't bring ourselves to do that. And then, we were talking about like, well, who else could try it? And then, you know, Ariel's worked with Heim forever and we know Danielle really well. and so we were kind of like, there's a few times she would come down just to help us
put down some harmonies. It was super casual.
Yeah, literally just came downstairs. And
just to see if like even the when we were still kind of, this is early days,
by the way, right? I
mean, yeah,
it's
very
a long time. So it's just to even see if the song was written in a range that made sense for a female. And there was something so, again, like, as you put it, like, it's part of, as the lyrics were starting to make more sense, that moment kind of like made sense. You know, she just very casually came in, sang it one take, and it was like, what are we even thinking about? You know, just this is like, this is a family. This makes right. perfect sense. This is like, there's already a chemistry. It's real, you know, and it's so much more. If we're referencing anything, we're referencing that relationship.
Yeah, exactly. That's the difference, is that me and Danielle sing together, people who know each other, part of a same community of musicians, work with the same producers, all this thing, all that kind of stuff. Then the reference of why we're singing together, like Ariel just put it, is a real human relationship. Me duetting with a country star, the reference, that
it's kitsch.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that there might not be a time in my life that I build that type of relationship with a country singer, but then that might even be pushing into that faraway eyes.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't Emmylou Harris, was it? It's a great country dueticist.
No, but Emmylou Harris is a great example, because I always think about her vocals on Bob Dylan Desire, and also how this is the first Vampire Weekend album that has a bunch of outside musicians. It's the first Vampire Weekend album that has featured guests, period. And even that was important too, that it's two people. It's Danielle and Steve Lacy, and they're both on multiple songs. And I kind of thought about that too, because there's a classic type of major label, pop, hip hop, whatever album, where you look at the features and you're kind of like, oh, they covered their bases. They got who's who of every genre. And that doesn't mean it's not artistic, but it happened, but it's not always artistic, where you're kind of like, hey, spread your chips out on the table. Did a duet with a country person, duet with an R&B person, got a rock singer, you know, you spread your chips out on the table. And that would never make sense for a Vampire Weekend album. So our thought too was also like, you know, when you think about Emmylou Harris singing back up on multiple songs on Desire or something, or, you know, what a Jean-Luc Ponty playing fiddle, you know, just the idea that there are people, even if it's only for one album, that people came together for the whole narrative, and that if somebody's worth bringing on one song, they're worth bringing on three songs. Danielle, ultimately, between lead and background vocals, maybe sings on like 11, 12 songs or something. Yeah. So for an album that hopefully is about human relationships, it makes sense to make it that way.
And that's it. The last episode of our second season of Broken Record. Thanks so much for listening. We're working hard to bring you a whole new set of interviews with your favorite musicians soon. In the meantime, reach out to us at brokenrecord@pushkin.fm if you have ideas of who you'd like to hear on the podcast. Thanks to Vampire Weekend's Ezra Koenig and producer Ariel Rekshid for joining us at Shangri-La Studios in Malibu. To hear their new record, Father the Bride, visit brokenrecordpodcast.com. Broken Record is produced by Justin Richmond and Jason Gambrell, with help from Mia Lobel, Jacob Smith, Julia Barton, and Jacob Weisberg. Special thanks to my co-hosts, Rick Rubin and Bruce Hudlam. For Pushkin Industries, I'm Malcolm Gladwell.